distinction between new stuff you need for cosmology and new stuff you can look for in colliders. I'll be talking about a few different projects I've worked on with various people. These are the people. Some of you know some of them. So I may as well get going. And again, if you have any questions or anything, or something's unclear in the middle, just shout at me and I'll do my best to answer. Okay, so we know that, we're quite confident that our universe is essentially all made of baryons, with very few antibaryons. I'm talking about baryons specifically because in terms of the regular matter that we can, the regular matter out there, we know that by mass, it's almost entirely made of baryons. And we have a very good determination of the total baryon density, the total fraction of baryons compared to the total energy density of the universe. It's roughly 5%, and we measured it with small error bars. And there are two ways to get at it. The best determination is based on looking at the CMB power spectrum. And as you vary the baryon density, you get different predictions for the standard power spectrum bulbs and wiggles. And by fitting to this, we get this this few percent determination. Now, another place where baryons come in is in predicting the light element abundances. So our picture is that you start off with a soup of protons and neutrons bouncing around. They come together as you cool below a fraction of an MeV, and they couple and you get the light elements just from their glomping together. And the only input to this calculation is the total baryon density. Once you have the total baryon density, it's just a matter of using known nuclear reaction rates and turning the crank. And it's not trivial, but it's used known data. And you end up with predictions for various light element abundances. And the point is that these predictions, the data compared with these predictions, shown as a function of the baryon density, matches up pretty well with the CMB value. So this is a slightly older plot, and the error bars on the baryon density are a bit bigger. There is some question about the lithium abundance, but this could potentially, the issue there is whether the lithium we see and are calling primordial is actually primordial. So. But in any case, we have a nice determination of the baryon density. And we would like a way to explain this. And there are three ingredients for this. And we expect we need three ingredients. We need to explain this baryon excess because after, for example, inflation, you typically expect equal numbers of baryons and antibaryons. So we want some mechanism after inflation, or possibly at the end of inflation, to explain the baryon density. And there are three ingredients. So the first is baryon number violation. This is fairly obvious. We want to go from a state with no net baryon number to one with a non-zero net baryon number. You need CP violation. And this is what you need to distinguish between matter and antimatter. So the point here is that even if I had baryon number violating processes going like crazy, if I didn't have any CNCP violation, the ones producing baryons would go at the same rate as the one producing antibaryons, and I wouldn't get a net asymmetry. So the CNCP violation are what you need to bias things. And finally, a departure from equilibrium. So again, as it says, if you get home late at night and you look at your cupboard, you have flour and butter, that doesn't necessarily mean you have these nice, delicious biscuits or scones. So we want specifically a mechanism for baryogenesis. And there are lots of them out there. Many of them operate using new physics at very high energies. It's somewhat harder to get at. I'm going to concentrate on the specific mechanism of electroweak baryogenesis. And part of the attractive part of this mechanism for me is that it's very testable. And it goes in three steps. So I'll go over these in more detail in a second. But the first is you have a strongly first-order electroweak phase transition. And if it's strongly first order, it goes to the nucleation of bubbles. CNCP violating processes near the bubble wall can generate various charge asymmetries. And then these charge asymmetries can bias the source of baryon number violation in the standard model called electroweak sphalerons to make more baryons and antibaryons. And one nice thing about this is that all of these ingredients are in principle present within the standard model. So the initial hope was that this baryogenesis mechanism could operate within the standard model, and you wouldn't need anything else to explain the baryon asymmetry. So here's my first cartoon. My first cartoon is the effective Higgs potential as a function of temperature. So this effective potential at finite temperature is actually more like a free energy. And if you go to very high enough energies, the only minimum of the potential lies at the origin. So you sit here, your Higgs BEV is zero, and you have no electric symmetry breaking. As you cool off for an appropriate potential, you might generate a second minimum that eventually becomes degenerate with the minimum at the origin. So the point is, you start over here, the potential evolves, a new minimum forms, but you're still stuck here. Now, if you go below the critical temperature being where this breaking vacuum is degenerate with the vacuum at the origin, you can end up with a slightly deeper vacuum. And at this point, it becomes energetically favorable to go here. But you have to get from here to here, and you can get from here to here by tunneling. So the way this tunneling process is realized is in terms of the nucleation of bubbles. So you nucleate a bubble. So the tunneling goes from here to here corresponds to nucleating a finite-sized bubble where you have a non-zero Higgs BEV within the surrounding plasma of the broken BEV. Yes?
If the Hubble rate is low,
yes,
then why should the field be in the minimum in the first place?
Okay, yes.
If reheating was at some low temperature, the field's been kicked around during inflation, it comes out of inflation sitting way up there, and it's just frozen by Hubble friction.
Oh, sure, yeah.
If the Hubble rate's high, other way around.
Yeah, you get Hubble trapped. So the picture I have here is that you have a fairly vanilla radiation-dominated cosmology at temperatures well above the weak scale. So yes, so I agree. There are other ways to do baryogenesis in low reheating mechanisms with low reheating mechanisms. I'm going to assume implicitly here that you reheated to some relatively high temperature compared to electroweak, and you just have normal radiation domination going into it. And then in that case, the Hubble damping essentially disappears at a relatively high temperature, and this picture is applicable. Right. But yeah, I agree that with a non-standard cosmology, especially with low overheating, the story could be different. Okay, so this is cartoon number two. So cartoon number two is a zoom in on one of the bubble walls. So here's the inside of a bubble where the Higgs BEV is non-zero. This is the outside where the Higgs BEV is zero. This is the surrounding plasma, and this is the bubble wall separating the two. And the point is that if I have CP violating interactions within the bubble wall, I can have stuff scatter off the wall, but with slightly different reflection and transmission coefficients for particle versus antiparticles or left versus right-handed states. And the upshot of this is that I can get a net chiral charge asymmetry in front of the bubble wall. And this is where the CP violation comes in. And the third step is Phalerons. So let me just flip forward and come back in a second. So these Phaleron transitions are present in the standard model. And these are non-perturbative transitions related to SU2 left instantons. So this corresponds to the fact that the SU2 vacuum structure is non-trivial. And in principle, you can have tunneling between them. So tunneling between them is what you call instantons. And this is the story at zero temperature. At finite temperature, instead of tunneling between these vacua, you can instead jump over the barrier through thermal fluctuations. So here, you get a rate per unit volume for these Phaleron transitions. And if you have, if in the electrically broken phase, they're essentially unsuppressed. So the rate per unit volume just goes like some coupling times temperature to the fourth. On the other hand, in the symmetric phase, in the broken phase, there's some net energy cost of making a Phaleron configuration, or I should say a net energy cost for going over the barrier. And this energy cost leads to an effective Boltzmann suppression of the Phaleron transitions. So now the rate per unit volume has a T4th, but it can get a big suppression by this ratio of Higgs BEV to temperature with some other factors. And the upshot of all this is if I flip back to my second cartoon, in the symmetric phase, where I have no Higgs BEV, the Phaleron rate goes like T to the fourth and is unsuppressed. It's much faster than Hubble. Whereas the Phaleron rate in the broken phase is very suppressed and tends to be much smaller than Hubble and therefore turned off. So what ends up happening is I produce my chiral asymmetry. My chiral asymmetry is acted on by the Phalerons. The Phalerons only act on the left-handed piece because they're associated with SC2 left. That converts this charge asymmetry. It biases its phalerons to make more baryons and antibaryons. Now that I have the baryons, the bubble wall zips across. The bubble wall is expanding out. The baryons are glumped inside the interior of the bubble, where the phalerons are now turned off. There's no more baryon violation, effectively, and you're left with a net baryon number. Okay, so here's a second cartoon of the charge asymmetries. With CP violation, what you get is, if you like, a net charge of left-handed quarks and an opposite charge of right-handed antiquarks. So at this point, there's zero net baryon number production. I've just sequestered the charge into a left-handed piece and a right-handed antipiece. And the phalerons come along and they eat up some of the left-handed piece, and you're left with a net baryon asymmetry after these guys annihilate. Okay, so the standard model, in principle, has all these ingredients. You can have, or at least you could potentially have a first-order electric phase transition. You can have, you know that the phalerons are present, and you know that you have CP violation in the form of the phase from the CKM matrix. But it turns out that it doesn't actually work within the standard model, and there are two problems. So the first is that with measured Higgs mass, the electric phase transition is not first order at all. So you don't get bubbles, and that's the first deal breaker. And the second thing is, even if we had a nice first order phase transition, it turns out that the amount of CP violation you have is not enough. Yes?
So in principle, how robust is the statement that there isn't enough CP violation? So like if you were to take the standard model at face value, but give yourself enough leeway to change the Higgs mass, change the shape of the potential, change the temperatures at which everything's taking place, could you overcome the impediment?
Not as far as I know. So I think the more accurate answer is people tried everything they could and didn't find anything that can work. What typically ends up happening is, to get CP violation, you very frequently end up with suppression by light quark masses. So light quark masses relative to the weak scale. And these factors end up meaning that the amount of baryon asymmetry you end up producing is orders and orders of magnitude too small. So that isn't to say that something hasn't been missed, but it looks highly unlikely that there's anything robust that would work, even if you allowed yourself to push around the Higgs potential a whole lot. Now, if we go slightly beyond the standard model, this mechanism can work. So I'm going to concentrate on a simple extension, the minimal supersymmetric standard model. I don't mean to push this. I don't mean to sell this theory. But it is an example that's been studied a whole lot. Electric baryogenesis could potentially work in it. And the things that work and don't work in this case typically apply to many other extensions of the standard model as well. So my concentration on this is going to be mainly as an illustration of the challenges you will face by trying to make electric baryogenesis consistent with LHC data. Okay, so just in passing, if we concentrate on the MSSM, the way it addresses these two shortcomings of the standard model for baryogenesis are, first of all, you want new matter that couples to the Higgs to make the phase transition first order. So you have to push around the Higgs potential to some extent. And in the MSSM, this comes from loop corrections from a light stop. And this idea goes back quite a ways. The other thing is that there are new sources of CP violation in the standard model, in the MSSM beyond the standard model. And in particular, with supersymmetry, you can have all kinds of new sources of CP violation from the soft terms. So these two features of supersymmetry are just what you need for baryogenesis to work. Okay. And in general, the stuff that you need for baryogenesis is also being tested by current experiments. So the fact that we have found a standard model like Higgs, and we're trying to measure its couplings very well, means that you can put strong constraints on any new stuff that will couple to the Higgs and strongly modify its potential. And there are also very, very precise searches for electric dipole moments. And generically, if you add CP violation to the standard model in some way or another, it will typically squidge out in terms of new contributions to electric dipole moments beyond the standard model predictions, which tend to be very, very small. So again, I'm looking at the MSSM. But I'll talk a little bit about more about other realizations later. So let me start off with CP violation. And within the CP violation, within the MSSM, the most promising source for the new CP, for the CP violation comes from the chargenos and neutrinos. And these are mixtures of the Higgs superpartners and the vector boson, electric vector boson superpartners. And what you want to do is, within the background of a time and spatially varying Higgs, you compute a net time rate of change of the Higgs-Eno charge. And the upshot of this is you compute it by taking this operator, computing in the background, and the leading contribution has some kind of loop structure like this. And the point is that you have some function that has depends on the time and space variation of the Higgs background, the VES, VU, and VD. And then it's also proportional to a coupling that violates CP. And this particular coupling involves the soft breaking mass M and the Higgs-Eno mass mu. So the picture here is that this Higgs-Eno source, and this Higgs-Eno source comes about from time-varying VEV, so in other words, from the bubble walls, you end up producing a net Higgs-Eno density. This net Higgs-Eno density is transferred into left and right-handed quark and swark densities through the Tapio-Kawa interaction. The sphalerons act on the left-handed piece, and again, you get rid of this, and you're left with some net baryon number. So this is an explicit realization of the earlier cartoon. And these are results. These are results by one group, actually calculating all these bubble wall dynamics and reflection and transmission and CP violating sources is a huge mess. And there are you have to make various approximations along the way, and there's a significant error bar. This is a relatively optimistic picture from this group, and what this diagram shows is as a function of the Beano mass and the Higgs-Eno mass, this with the assumption that the Weino mass is twice the Beano mass, these regions, these dotted and dashed lines, correspond to values of the phase, the effective CP violating phase, such that you get the right baryon asymmetry, such you get the observed value. So the solid line, if you live on the solid line, if you have a maximal CP violating phase, this is where, along the solid line, in this region, you get enough baryon number production. On the other hand, as I turn down the phase to be smaller and smaller, so here I go from 1 to 0.3 to 0.1, if I'm at 0.1, I have to live on this dashed line, and I'm much more restricted. And the other thing you see is that this region that works for baryogenesis has a kind of a two-prong structure. So this two-prong structure corresponds to when mu is either degenerate with M1 or M2. And the reason for this degeneracy is, if I go back, the ultimate source for the CP violation that you need for baryogenesis is from loops like this, where you compute, again, the time rate of change of the Higgs-Eno current. And the Higgs-Eno current, the leading contribution has a loop where the Higgs-Eno mixes into one of the gauge-Enos, and here's an insertion of the Higgs background that's spatially varying. And the point is that when this mass becomes degenerate with the gauge-Eno mass, you get a resonance. And what you're seeing is these two prongs is a resonance enhancement.
Non's incredibly insensitive to the stop mass. So in other words, by varying the stop mass, it doesn't give you any additional leverage in how much of a first order phase transition you're getting.
Okay. So the assumption going into this is that you have a strongly first order phase transition with a specific choice for the bubble profile, and a specific shape for the bubble profile. And this bubble profile and the strength of the phase transition are set by the stop. But as far as this calculation goes, that phase transition is being treated as a fixed background. And then we within that background of expanding bubbles, whether it comes from stops or something else, this is the amount of baryon production you get based on these CP violating phases.
No, they
do depend on the stop.
Would I expect significant changes in this plot if I vary it dramatically?
Yeah. Yes. So again, they choose a particular background that coincides roughly with what you expect from a typical light stop in the limit they need it to work. If you start pushing around the stop parameters, so let's say the stop mass, that's what you really have access to, and in its mixings, the bubble wall profiles will change a bit. In principle, how fast the bubbles are expanding can change a bit, and this will change the barrier number production. So for example, if your bubbles move really, really fast, you don't actually have much time for these collisions and the spiral lines to take place in front of the bubble wall. On the other hand, if everything is very slow, the chiral asymmetries you produce from scattering off the bubble wall can be washed out before they're converted into baryons. So there's a balance, and you end up with an optimal wall velocity. And this calculation assumes essentially a fairly optimal wall velocity. So there's a correlation, but as far as this calculation goes, they're treating that stop story as being some fixed background, and they're working within it.
But it's not like I have to choose a very specific anything in order to make that work, right? But if I just roll dice and change stop mixing and masses, it might change the angle between those two or something, but it wouldn't change qualitatively what that wants to.
Yes, but assuming that you have a strongly first order transition. Now, that turns out to be non-trivial, and that will turn out to give very, very tight constraints on stop parameters. So in some sense, by fixing this background, they've implicitly fixed stop parameters within a fairly small range. Yes?
What are these bubble walls made out of, and in which part of the universe? In the history of the universe, which section or is all this happening?
So the transition is happening when the generic temperature is about 100 GeV. And what happens in the bubble wall is that, I can erase here. So here's my bubble. And then let's say I call this coordinate R, going out from the outside of it. So I can plot the Higgs Vev as a function of R. So if I'm inside the bubble, my Higgs Vev is basically a constant. But as I approach the bubble wall, as I approach this boundary, where I have to go through some transition where it falls off to zero. So what I call a bubble wall is just this transition region. Oh no! But these really are expanding bubbles, and there really is a boundary between these two phases.
And they're made up of which?
So the thing that's varying from inside the bubble to outside the bubble is just the Higgs background value. So here I have a non-zero Higgs background value. Here I have a zero value, and physics in this phase looks different from physics in this phase. So here my vector bosons have a mass. Here they don't. Okay, so we've seen how much CP violation, how much baryon production you can get, and what it implies for this M1 mu plane. But we can take the phases that we seem to need for baryogenesis, and if I flip back, if I start to make my phase really small, in this case 0.03, I'm stuck to live in this little sliver, and as I turn the phase down more and more, the region that works falls off to zero. So I need relatively large phases for this to work. And this will feed into electric dipole moments. So at one loop, for the light stuff, or light generations, I have a loop that involves a neutralino, or possibly a chargeino, with a fermion going to its fermion superpartner and spitting off a photon. So this generates an electric dipole moment operator if there's CP violation. And these contributions tend to be too big relative to what's observed for relatively large phases, but they can be decoupled if I make the fermion mass very large. So the point is, if I crank up my fermion masses to be very big, the size of the one loop contribution relative to the fermion mass essentially disappears up this way. And these things, I can essentially decouple them entirely if I just put my first and second generation fermions up to something like 10 TeV. And this isn't so crazy from the point of view of LHC limits on light generation masses. So this contribution to the EDM isn't a problem. But there's a non-decouplable contribution to the EDMs that you're stuck with. And you're stuck with this within the MSSM because, first of all, your Higgs is forced to be light. Some of your Higgs are forced to be light. Your weak vector bosons are forced to be light. And some combination of charginos and neutralinos are forced to be light. So at two loops, you have these so-called bar Z type diagrams where here's a fermion field, and you're connecting to loops of charginos or neutralinos with vector bosons or Higgses. And the point is that I'm not able to decouple these because my charginals and neutrinos have to be relatively light. If I make them too heavy, I end up just switching off the baryon asymmetry. And the values you get from this with the sizes of the phases that work for electric baryogenesis are roughly in the ballpark of what you of current limits. So the best limit, for example, on the electron EDM is about 10 to the minus 28. This is from the ACME experiment. And what this plot shows is that for fixed M1 and for various values of the phases, you're forced to have relatively degenerate Higgsino-Bino. So roughly the current limit is about 10 to the minus 28. So you have to live essentially within this region here. So electroweak baryogenesis is still viable in terms of its CP violation, but you do need this degeneracy. And again, the degeneracy comes about because you're being forced to live out on this Higgsino-Bino branch. It turns out that the Higgsino-Bino branch is more or less ruled out. So at this point, even just for the CP violation, the EDM constraints, you're forced into a very specific region of the primary space. Okay. No. The decoupling point is that some combination of charginals and neutralinos has to stay light for this CP violation mechanism to work, independent of how I do supersymmetry breaking.
Okay, sure. But I mean, you could decouple the one loop diagram because you can make the scalar heavy, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. But I'm not able to make the charginals and neutralinos all heavy because that would also shut off the baryon production. Sorry, it shut down the CP violating sources near the bubble wall. So I'm not able to decouple these without also turning off baryogenesis. So if I turn off electric baryogenesis, yes, I can decouple this, even with big phases, but I don't have baryogenesis. So this leads me to the specific spectrum, where I have relatively light electroweak gauginos, relatively light Higgsinos. We'll see in a second that we need a relatively light stop. And we know that we have a fairly light standard model like Higgs. The first and second generation fermions have to be fairly heavy because of these EDM bounds, or at least the first generation guys. And you typically expect the second generation guys to go along for the ride. The gluino can be sort of in between. You don't worry so much about this. And it's going to turn out that because one of the stops is going to have to be light, the other one is going to have to be very heavy to get the Higgs mass right. So I'm going to call this a mini stop split spectrum. It's like split supersymmetry, except with a light stop. And it does require a little bit of tuning in the sense that I have a relatively heavy stop, but it's what we're forced into. So the second thing I want to get into is a strongly first order electroweak transition and what this implies and how it connects to the LHC. So again, we have specifically the rate for sphalerons in the broken phase gets this exponential suppression. And this is good because I can have my sphalerons going very quickly in this phase, but then the baryons get glomped inside the bubbles, and the sphalerons are turned off. And now that my sphalerons are turned off, this prevents them from being washed out. If I still had sphaleron transitions going on here, the sphaleron transitions would tend to relax the net baryon number down to zero. So I want to make sure that this is turned off. And there's a roughly approximate quantitative condition for that. And that approximate quantitative condition for that is that the value of the Higgs bev relative to the critical temperature So this is the Higgs valve in the broken phase at the critical temperature relative to the critical temperature has to be larger than about 1. So that's essentially the condition that I need to shut these off sufficiently relative to Hubble to avoid washout. So this is a condition on the strength, if you like, on the strength of the first order transition beyond just it being first order. So in the MSSM, you get the strongly first order transition from a light stop. And this is a stop mass matrix. I have the usual supersymmetry breaking piece, and I have left-right mixing from this off-diagonal thing. And diagonalizing this, you get two mass eigenstates, stop one, stop two, with some mixing angle theta. And it turns out that the limit that works, and the only limit that seems to work, is when you make the right-handed soft mass much less than the left-handed stop mass, and you take the decoupling limit. So you take the pseudoscalar Higgs mass to be very large. And in this limit, you can integrate out the heavy states and get an effective Lagrangian. And the leading effective Lagrangian has what is essentially the right-handed soft mass as an effective quadratic piece. And as a quartic piece, you get an effective Higgs portal coupling between the stop and the Higgs with some coupling Q. And matching, again, the quadratic piece, the mass piece is just the soft mass. And the Q is roughly Takikawa squared times some stuff times something that is suppressed by left-right mixing. So we're going to want Q to be really big, which means that we're going to want left-right stop mixing to be very small, which means that our left-handed stop is going to have to be very heavy to get 125 GeV Higgs. Right, but in any case, we have a light, mostly right-handed stop. Now, if we work in this effective theory and compute the thermal effective potential, there are essentially three pieces. You get your tree-level effective Higgs potential, and there's a thermal correction to the effective quadratic term. There is this funny non-analytic piece. So let's just ignore this for the piece. Let's ignore this piece for now. And then we have a quartic part. So the quartic part combined with the quadratic piece means that if I go to high enough temperatures, the coefficient of the quadratic term becomes positive, and my electroweak symmetry is restored. So this is the symmetry restoration at high energies. And on the other hand, as T goes to 0, I destabilize my potential, and you get the usual Higgs breaking story. Now, the additional piece that comes up at one loop is this correction. So this correction is essentially the thermal stop mass squared to 3/2 power with a temperature dependent coefficient. And this thermal mass in the Higgs background depends on our Q coupling, this effective Higgs portal coupling. And then there's some combination from a thermal correction to the Higgs mass and the bare Higgs mass itself, the stop mass term. So I'm going to call this stuff together del m squared. And if you look at the specific limit where q is pretty big and this del m squared goes to 0, what you get from this is this term turns into a cubic piece. And a cubic piece is exactly what you want in the sense that you start off at relatively high temperatures where this part is positive. The cubic coefficient, you get a cubic term that's negative, and that means that as I go away from the origin, you start going up, and then you turn over from the cubic piece, that turns you down. But then eventually, for large field value, the quartic piece comes up and stabilizes you. So this is exactly what you want to get a first order transition, and you're really relying on the cubic piece to drive it. Without the cubic piece, it's just a second order transition. And you can show, based on this effective potential, in the optimal limit of del m squared goes to 0, that this VEV over TC condition that has to be larger than about 1 is roughly Q to the 3/2 over lambda, where lambda is a quartic and Q, again, is this thing that goes roughly like the top Yukawa squared. So the other thing that comes out at large Q is you have a large effective stop Higgs coupling. And this is going to feed into Higgs production and decay rates. So the dominant production mechanism for the Higgs, standard model like Higgs at the LHC, is gluon fusion. So this is generated by diagrams like this in the standard model, where you have two gluons coming in, you have a loop of top quarks, and Higgs coming out. In this supersymmetric extension, you also have loops of the stop, contributing in much the same way as the top. And for positive Q, which is what you need for a first order transition, this interferes constructively with the standard model top diagram. You can also look at the decay rate for Higgs to gamma gamma, which in the standard model is dominated by the W loop, with a small destructive interference from the top loop. And you'll have an additional destructive interference with the W loop from a loop of the stop. And again, with a big Q coefficient here. So if you take all this together, you can go off and compute the strength of the phase transition and its relative effect on Higgs production through gluon fusion and its decay to diphotons. So this is kind of a busy plot, but let me try to explain it. This Q is the same Q as before. And this mx squared is roughly the negative of mu squared. So positive values of this correspond to mu squared negative. So the more negative you make mu squared, the more cancellation you have of the thermal term, and the better your transition. So if you make mu squared too negative, you end up destabilizing your potential, and that's a yellow region. The black line corresponds to where you get a strongly first order phase transition with VEV over T at the critical temperature of 1. As I go away from this, this is 1, and it gets weaker. This is like 0.8 and like 0.6, it's like 1.2, 1.4, and so on. The dashed red lines are the enhancements in Higgs production through gluon fusion relative to the standard model. So in the MSSM, we expect Q on the order of 1, which means we have to live kind of up here already. But this is also telling us that our enhancement, the gluon fusion rate, is something like 80, 90%. And now, if I start going away from the pure MSSM, or if I have large running enhancements of Q, I can start going out more in this direction, and my enhancement isn't quite as large. But typically, as long as my Q is in within the perturbative regime, I'm getting a pretty big enhancement for gluon fusion. I can also look at the total production times branching fraction for inclusive Higgs production to diphoton decay. And it turns out that the reduction in the branching ratio of Higgs to diphotons is less than the enhancement in the production rate. So I still get a net enhancement by a factor of, let's say, 40, 50%, depending on where I'm living. So I take this together. I look at Higgs data. A fairly generic result is that my gluon fusion production rate in the MSSM or MSSM-like theories is larger than about 60%. Relative to the standard model, and Higgs to diphotons inclusively is larger than the standard model by about 30% at least. And I can compare this to existing Higgs data. So for example, the Atlas Higgs to diphoton inclusive production rate is roughly on the order of the standard model. So here, this is the strength of the signal, essentially the effective rate relative to the standard model prediction. Atlas is a little bit big. CMS, it turns out, is a little bit small. And in particular, the Higgs to WW rate is pretty close to the standard model at Atlas. And this gives a strong constraint on enhancements to total gluon fusion production. CMS has done a combined analysis where they look at production rates in different channels. And for example, for gluon fusion rates, they actually have something that's roughly 1 plus or minus about 15%. So this alone, compared to our enhancement, essentially rules out this simple-minded MSSM picture of electric baryogenesis through the stop loop effect on the transition. And then the fitting to Higgs data has been done more carefully by these folks relatively recently. Okay, so now I want to mention some caveats and argue that maybe there are ways to wiggle out of this. Not that I find these ways to wiggle out of it especially compelling, but in principle, it's not impossible. So one thing is that it's been suggested that you could have other supermarketers floating around that aren't too heavy. They could interfere destructively with the enhancement from the stop loop. Again, this isn't easy to make work, but in principle, things could change a bit. There's also maybe fairly large uncertainties in the Higgs data. Probably a larger caveat is that the estimate we've made for our thermal potential was based on perturbation theory. And it turns out that the perturbative calculation is really right on the edge of being trustable. And ideally, you would prefer to have a more accurate lattice simulation. And lattice studies seem to find that you still need stop masses less than about 155, 160 GeV. So the lattice calculations actually seem to agree pretty well with the perturbative calculations. But still, there's a pretty big uncertainty associated with this. So a second direction that we tried and other people have tried is what about looking for these light stops directly? So both in a perturbative calculation And in the lattice calculation, the stop mass has to be less than about 160 or so GeV. It seems like you ought to be able to see that at the LHC, or maybe even other colliders based on what they have already, because this is, after all, lighter than the top. Yeah, this is the next part. So it turns out the actual constraints on light stops depend on how they decay. And the way they decay depends largely on phase space. So the two-body decays will tend to dominate if they're kinematically available. So the two-body decays are top neutralino or B chargino. In principle, the chargino could be somewhat heavier, and it can cut off this thing. And this will turn off, obviously, if the stop mass is less than top plus neutralino mass. So if these are both turned off, your next course of action is a three or possibly four-body decay, where stop goes to, if you like, an off-shell top and a neutralino. And the off-shell top is going to give you a BW. And in principle, if your mass splitting is small enough, even that W can be off-shell, and you'll get a four-body channel. And finally, there's a potential two-body flavor violating channel where you go to C neutralino. And typically, what dominates depends on phase space. So if I assume that my chargino isn't especially light, here I have two-body, here I have three-body, and here I have some mixture of two-body flavor violating and four-body. So this dominating is pretty clear. What happens between flavor violating and four-body requires a bit more work. So we looked at this under certain assumptions. So the likelihood of the flavor violating decay depends on how much flavor violation you have in your MSSM. In principle, you could have more than in the standard model. We look specifically at minimal flavor violation because this is sort of a very reasonable way for MSSM flavor not to disagree with the data. These are examples for certain sets of parameters. Here, the yellow region means the four-body dominates. The green means the two-body flavor violating dominates. And what we find for small stop mixing, which is what's motivated by the phase transition, is you tend to have the four-body domination except close to the kinematic limit. And that the flavor violating ramps up as you make your left-right mixing larger. So this is within minimal flavor violation. In principle, you could have more flavor violation, and the flavor violating can dominate. But I guess the main point about this is that it's worth considering both four-body and flavor violating searches for looking at the decay modes of the stop. So we looked at both of these. We did a collider study, and so did these folks, Delgado, Giudice, Storia, Pierre, and Estremia. And what we found more or less agrees with some Atlas studies that came out after we did our analysis. So the Atlas studies have more data and slightly fancier search techniques, so I'm just going to show their result. This is the current limit on direct stop production from the LHC using 7 and 8 TeV data. This is the stop mass. This is your neutralino mass that's assumed to be the lightest superpartner. And the point is that in this region, you have two-body decays dominating, and you get very, very strong constraints out to almost 700 GeV. This wedge is a three-body region, and this wedge is a two-body or four-body region. So the place where you want to live for electric baryogenesis is just right in this corner, to the left of the dashed line. And the point is that the important thing here is that these various searches more or less rule out this region for light stops anyhow, whether they decay through flavor violating modes or four-body modes, or even three-body modes down there. So maybe there's a little gap down here, but it's not very plausible. So this is the second point. These light stops, you need to strongly modify the phase transition, are very, very constrained by current direct searches as well as the indirect Higgs searches. Actually, that's my next slide. Sure.
Does the bounds here, then, those include the measurement of the TT bar cross section? Or just from direct searches?
So these solutions are direct searches. So this is the Atlas analyses, a similar CMS story. in principle, these searches all assume that one or the other mode dominates, and they could weaken a little bit if you have a mixed branching fraction, but they're not likely to weaken all the way down to here. Okay, but yeah, you're asking about our parity violation. In principle, this could weaken things. We haven't looked at it in very much detail, especially in this light region. But again, yeah, it's worth looking at more carefully. Although my motivation is not quite as strong as it would be if there wasn't also this Higgs constraint. The other thing is that in our analyses and in the collider analyses, it was assumed that the LHC decays happen promptly. And in principle, they don't have to happen promptly. So if you have delayed stop decays, it's not clear whether the existing searches are directly applicable or not. And this is another way in which it's probably actually not that much different from RPV at the end of the day, but the current searches could be weaker in this case. On the other hand, I should mention that if your stop is very long-lived, you get very strong constraints. So there might be some weaker limits in between, but you can't make your stop essentially metastable. Okay, so the story for the MSSM is, okay, I'd be willing to say it's fairly gloomy in that you're constrained from various directions. So you're constrained from the fact that it's hard to get enough CP violation without being ruled out by EDM bounds. It's hard to change the Higgs potential for two reasons. So first of all, generically, to change the Higgs potential, you need stuff that couples fairly strongly to the Higgs. And this will typically change Higgs production and decay rates. On top of that, the new stuff has to also be typically fairly light, and you tend to get strong bounds from direct constraints. Now, one variation of this that we've been talking about a little bit about recently is if you have so-called neutral naturalness partners. So in theories like this, you can get things, for example, that act like a stop in terms of how it couples to the Higgs, but that doesn't carry any SU3 color charge. And in that case, the direct searches would be much weaker, and the effects on Higgs production through gluon fusion would essentially be nil. So in that case, you would need a much more precise Higgs coupling measurement to get at that kind of thing. Okay, but in general, by modifying the phase transition, you're gonna have new direct stuff and new Higgs deviation rates. New source of CP violation, again, same story. So actually, this slide is just repeating what I just said. One thing I've been looking at recently is a potential loophole. And the idea here is that suppose instead of doing electric baryogenesis with our Higgs, suppose you do it with some other field that breaks the electric symmetry in the early universe. So the idea here is suppose I have our usual Higgs field that couples to the standard model in basically the usual way, plus some second electric doublet. And it turns out that it's possible for this phi field to get a VEV before the Higgs does. And it's possible for this first transition to be strongly first order. So now this phi field goes through a strongly first order electric phase transition. You go from an electric symmetric phase to an electric broken phase driven by the exotic phi field. But then later on, as you cool down, your phi breaking state evolves smoothly into our vacuum, where now the phi has no VEV, but the Higgs has a VEV. So here's a cartoon of it. So you have some first order phase transition into this phi VEV, and then as the temperature cools, this minimum raises relative to this minimum. And instead of having a potential where this is deeper than this, you evolve smoothly around the circle down into the usual Higgs vacuum. So the upshot of this is that I could do all the heavy lifting of electric baryogenesis in this first phase transition, where I transition from the symmetric phase to a broken phase. And by being in a broken phase, first of all, I can get the bubble walls I need. But second of all, I can also turn off the electric sphalerons, provided this phase transition is strongly enough first order. And the rate for electric sphalerons depends on roughly the orthogonal sum of this VEV with this VEV. So as long as I transition to here, and the orthogonal sum of this VEV plus this VEV always stays fairly large, my sphalerons will always be turned off. and I won't wash out any of my Baryon asymmetry. Now, there are two advantages of this. The first is that the new stuff that I need to make the phase transition strongly first order, things, let's say, similar to a stop, or possibly even new tree-level contributions, only need to couple to this exotic doublet, not our Higgs. So the Higgs rates, in that sense, will be more protected. The other thing is that also as far as CP violation goes, the CP violating sources, let's say some new fermions, some new Tarantino neutrino-like things, could couple exclusively to this scalar rather than this scalar. And this would also reduce the contributions to electric dipole moments for standard model objects. They would still filter through, but at a lower level, I would guess by about a loop lower. But we still have to look at that within a specific realization. So in any case, this looks like a potential loophole, a way to weaken the limits on electric baryogenesis. But we find that it's not as much of a loophole as we had initially hoped. And the reason for this is that you have essentially some basic requirements. So for this story to work, you want your exotic doublet to get a VEV before the Higgs VEV. And that means that this exotic field has to be destabilized more easily than the Higgs. The second thing is that you want this transition to complete fairly efficiently. You don't want to get trapped in this exotic vacuum and super cool a whole lot, and then transition to a regular vacuum, because in that case you dump a whole lot of entropy after the supercooling, and that would essentially dilute all the baryons you worked so hard to produce in the first place. And third of all, you have to make sure that this Fowleron suppression, which, as I said, depends on the orthogonal sum of these VEVs, stays relatively large. So it turns out that if you apply these three conditions, what we find, at least within specific realizations, is that we're forced to have the doublet mass is less than about 150 GeV. And by having a doublet, we're forced to have new charge states. And the upshot of this is these new charge states, they're scalar, but they have to be fairly light. So you can go off and look at those in various ways. You can look at them indirectly from things like precision electroweak effects, or you can look at for them or through Higgs rate deviations. Or you can also look for them directly just with standard collider searches. And typically this 100, 150 GeV range is on the edge of what you can get at with the LHC now. And the current 14 or the upcoming 14 or so TV run will push things a bit further. But still, it's hard to get much, much better than that. But in any case, even within this loophole, there's still reasonable ways to get at the new physics that you need for baryogenesis. So our claim is that, or I guess our soft claim, we don't have a specific theorem, but our general claim is that it's very difficult to make electroweak baryogenesis work while still remaining consistent with direct light particle searches and indirect Higgs rates, and possibly also EDM bounds, unless you write down a theory that's very, very finely tuned. So in the MSSM, we see all these features coming up. We see the EDM bounds being fairly strong. The hardest part is the fact that we seem to need a very light stop for the first order electroweak phase transition, and this light stop is basically ruled out by direct searches or Higgs rates. There are other ways in extended scenarios that do a little bit better that aren't ruled out. So for example, NMSSM type theories or R symmetric theories. But even in those cases, you still get similar limits and you tend to have to tinker with the theory more than you would like to make things work. So again, these are generic places to look, and I guess I'll just wrap up there.
Would you be able to, if you set aside the question of getting an FCP violation, suppose you were just to couple the Higgs to some other neutral scalar to give you the right first order phase transition, how does that scenario hold up?
So do you have in mind that the new scalar will act like a stop, in a sense, and change it at loop level or at tree level?
I suppose either.
Okay, so the loop level story should look a lot like the stop, except the direct Higgs limits will be weakened if it doesn't carry any color charge. So that's a bit like the kind of neutral naturalness picture. You can also couple a new state to the Higgs such that you modify its tree level potential. And this is more or less what's done in the NMSSM. And this can work, but you have to be very careful in that you want to change the potential a lot, but you have to make sure your singlet doesn't mix too much with the standard model-like state. So that's tricky to do. And the other thing is, here your bubble walls are being driven by a cubic term at tree level instead of a loop-generated cubic term with a temperature coefficient. So the nice thing about the coefficient of the cubic term being proportional to temperature is that it turns off on its own as you cool off. Whereas if you're driven by tree level, it doesn't turn off as well, and you have to be careful that your bubbles don't run away on you. So either you get stuck and your phase transition never completes, or even if it does complete, your bubble walls might expand really, really quickly, more quickly than you like, and if your bubble walls are expanding too quickly, you get a suppression of barrier number you get at the end of the day because you just don't have enough time for all these complicated reflection and diffusion and Sphalerine transitions to make baryons. So things can work in principle, but you have to be very careful with the parameters of the theories to get it to work the way you want it to.
You said that this mechanism where you have a second Higgs-like doublet requires that you have charged neutron particles. Is that because of the form that the potential needs to take so that you get that mechanism where it goes from the bed in one Higgs to the bed in the other?
Oh, no. You're forced to get charged particles just because if you have a doublet,
it's just an SE2 doublet.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And then my other question was, for that, to get the mechanism that you want where you roll from one bed at one temperature to another, is that like a very generic feature, or do you have to tune the potential at all?
So it turns out that it's not so, I can draw you a little cartoon for this. So if I write this down as my quadratic piece, and I write my if I have a potential of this form, it's minimized when it's minimized for this thing equal to a constant. And this thing being equal to a constant defines an ellipse in this phi 1, phi 2 plane.
Right.
So so for the potential you want, that tends to look kind of like a trough, you can take a potential like this and start to deform it. And as long as you don't deform it too radically, it's relatively easy to get this first transition happening and then second transition. So it's not entirely generic, but you can think of this form as essentially moderately sized deformations of a potential that looks like that.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you again.